This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco Cell Culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels. Welcome to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. In the December issue of The Scientist, Alan Dove writes about the quest for developing a vaccine for cytomegalovirus. In our podcast this week, Dove asks researcher Gayard Mall why he spent his career combating a virus that infects many people but seriously harms relatively few. They also discuss how cytomegalovirus works on Mall's approach to a vaccine. But first, staff writer Carrie Grins has a roundup from The Scientist Daily News.
In the latest issue of Genes and Development, researchers report on a newly discovered viral strategy for evading RNA silencing in plants. Jeffrey Perkel reports on thescientist.com that the scientists found the cucumber mosaic virus protein, 2B, binds to and inhibits the protein Arginat-1 in Arabidopsis. This is the first time a virus has been shown to halt silencing by binding an effector protein in the silencing pathway. The group showed that 2B interacts with Arginat-1 to suppress both endogenous microRNA processing and virus-induced gene silencing. The findings imply that both RNA interference and virus-induced gene silencing work by using similar machinery, and that Arginat-1 could be the so-called slicer in the mechanism. Rockefeller University's Nam Hai Chua, who led the study, said it's likely there are other slicers since Arginat-1 is one of a family of 10 Argonauts. He also speculates it's likely that 2B can interact with more than one of them. James Carrington at Oregon State University points out that other viral suppressors of RNA silencing target different parts of the silencing pathway. He said, quote, "There's 20 ways to skin this cat, and viruses are using all those ways." Also in the Scientist Daily News, Karen Pallarito writes about difficulties facing the Food and Drug Administration in assuring that data from relevant drug studies are fully disclosed. In particular, are concerns over the safety of the antifibrinolytic drug aprotinin. The FDA's Cardiovascular and Renal Drugs Advisory Committee met earlier in the year to review the drug after several observational studies raised safety concerns. Only then did Bayer Healthcare admit it did not immediately turn over data to the FDA on postoperative complications in patients given the drug. Bayer gave the FDA its data and said it regrets the error. The issue of disclosing data on drug safety was hashed out in several recent letters published in the New England Journal of Medicine. One letter, written by William R. Hyatt, who chaired the FDA's advisory committee, alleges that Dennis T. Mangano, the principal scientist, founder, and CEO of the Ischemia Research and Education Foundation, also did not fully disclose data on aprotinin safety. Mangano writes in the same issue that he and his colleagues made every effort to have the FDA review in detail all of the data, documentation, and operating procedures used in the study. Hyatt says the safety of aprotinin remains an open case. Stephen Finley, the managing editor of Consumer Reports' Best Buy Drugs, says, quote, "This is yet another example of why there has to be full clinical trial registry and full releases of data at appropriate times and after appropriate cleaning up of the data."
You can find full stories of The Scientist Daily News on our website, www.thescientist.com. Next, feature contributor Alan Dove speaks with Gayard Mall about a struggle to develop a vaccine for cytomegalovirus.
I'm talking with Gayard Mall, a professor at the Wistar Institute who works on cytomegalovirus. Now, Dr. Mall, a lot of our listeners will think of cytomegalovirus, CMV, as a relatively benign virus. 50 to 80% of us already have it, and it doesn't seem to be doing us any harm. So, as a starting point, what are the main clinical issues that one worries about with this virus?
There are probably a number of those, and anytime you have a number of those, you know, each one may not necessarily look so important, but the aggregate in cost is pretty high. And you can say there are only 8,000 children which are dumb, deaf, and blind born because of congenital CMV infection, but add that every year, and that is then a cost over a lifetime, you come very fast to 200,000 or whatever the number is. You can make that calculation yourself, which, and the attendant costs of taking care of them, the attendant cost of the caregivers even, who are less productive in other ventures, you know, whatever you have, right. A mother or so on, you have to take care of a child like this. So it is, from that point of view, not an AIDS epidemic, by no means, you know. On the other hand, the number is pretty high of accumulated people who have it.
So I saw this statistic in the, I guess it was the National Academy mm-hmm. of Sciences report a few yeah. years ago, Vaccines for the New Millennium, where they had done some cost-benefit yeah. calculations on different vaccines.
And, put it pretty
and
high up.
They were talking in billions of dollars, yes. the impact of, of CMV.
But, you know, when you're here, it's only 8,000 on a yearly basis. I'm talking only now the congenital infection. I'm not talking about the other...
So these are people who... The mother did not have CMV, they yeah. got exposed to it during the pregnancy.
Usually the second child, because the first one is in the daycare center, it brings it home, and then the mother gets it. Most likely these women have a second child, you know,
right.
it's a normal process of human reproduction. And they come back and get infected during that period of time, and then through transplacental type of infection, the child gets it.
And getting it that yeah. way is... quite a different matter from getting it as a
yeah.
as a child.
And a mother in that sense also is slightly immunocompromised, otherwise she would reject the fetus.
Right.
Right, because that is definitely a foreign body. And so the effect may be stronger. On the other hand, they do know that women who have a very strong response to the virus will have a much lower chance of transmitting it. And the other way around, the child which is born, which let's say has very high titer or T cell response, is actually will not have a problem. But many others, they will still produce. And
right.
here's one of the conundrums, because you say this child has all the immune system necessary, and still it produces virus.
Right.
Okay. So. Can we actually make a vaccine?
So you were looking at moving human genes into the murine virus
right.
to see, using the mouse then as a model.
We thought that we could actually use the mouse virus, putting them in humans, and then it would be a live infection. They would produce it, and then the human protein would be seen, obviously the mouse protein also,
right.
but we didn't care because that doesn't multiply. The multiplication of the virus wouldn't be there, and these cells would be killed after a certain while, after the immune system is ramped up, but we also would have induced now the human one. And we could put IE1, the immediate early protein 1, then the PP65 and the GB, you know, is very important ones for
right.
the humoral response and for the B cell response. So you would have all of those you could place in there, as many as we need. Now, you can easily see that we start to humanize that thing. Okay, so which ones are necessary until that thing becomes a zoonotic disease?
Right. You don't want to start the next avian flu, in other words.
Okay. And I think I made it very clear that in a paper that is... I feel that it is something which we do need to consider and exclude. And the only way to exclude it, to go so far until we see that it actually works, that you actually can get a transmission.
Right. So the idea is if you are going to use the murine virus in humans or parts of the murine virus in humans, you need a detailed understanding
yes.
of what you need to cripple
yes.
in order to prevent it from becoming a zoonotic disease.
Yeah. The interest we have is only in those proteins which are important for the immunization.
Right.
Now we could reach the point where the virus all of a sudden becomes dangerous. Okay, in the sense of really replicating, and then
right.
you would have another disease to concern yourself with. And it wouldn't be balanced anymore. okay, it would be having all kinds of other things in there, and then you know, all bets are off in this evolutionary balance. So, but you, in that sense, the way to go about it, or at least in my mind, would be to investigate what these proteins do and disable that function and keep the rest of the protein in.
Right.
Okay. And if you do this with one protein, that would be dangerous, because you would find something would happen and the whole thing would revert or recover or for whatever, recombine with some other virus, you know, where that, what you want to have is on many. And that is the essential take-home lesson. It is not a single thing which is the block, that there are many. And the accumulation of it makes it appear as if it is species-specific. And that's at least the approach I feel is essential. I want to know what I'm dealing with.
One more digression. You're an artist.
Well, this actually, I when I be addressed like this, you know, there's always a little bit of a problematic aspect to it, because, you know, in the scientific field, you know, it sounds a bit fuzzy, and in the science in the artistic field sounds so rational, you know, whatever. But I can only tell you, I feel that I work with the same principles. We just use different materials. That means what we call a hypothesis generation. You know, you cannot do a hypothesis-driven research until you have an hypothesis. And most people forget that. That's what they think of as science. But there's a step before. And in that sense, in my case, that's seeing. I see a lot of things. I see the unusual out of the mass of material. If I sit in the microscope, I drive through like on a highway, and I see not the stuff which all the cars, okay, but I see something which is unusual in the landscape. That's the easiest analogy I can give you, and those things I look up. So from the arts point of view, it's the same way. You have either you want to express something, and then you see for a way to do it. So I use all kinds of techniques. You know, this one was a sculpture exhibit, and there was a marble piece, there was a cast a bronze piece, there was woodworking, there was sheet metal work, it was all over the place. With whatever does it right. Oh, I think it does it right. Okay. And the nice thing about it is I don't have to prove anything.
And art is never wrong.
And on the other hand, whatever I do produce is very fast not mine anymore, because the person who is actually looking at it will completely interpret it differently. And that's, so I give them actually basically only something to hang on to.
You can read more about a potential for a cytomegalovirus vaccine in the December issue of The Scientist. And be sure to check out thescientist.com for more from the magazine. You'll also find more daily news updates, web exclusives, and weekly podcast features. This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.